assessment.
Now more than ever, government should free every person detained without sufficient legal basis, including political prisoners and others detained simply for expressing critical or dissenting views. COVID-19 poses a huge challenge to the whole society as governments take firm steps to enforce physical distancing.
I visited Julian Assange in London, in Belmarsh Prison, on the 9th of May, and then also reported back to the UK, to Sweden, the US and Ecuador, the four states that were mainly responsible for his treatment in the past 6 years. And I visited him with two medical experts. We came to the conclusion that he had been exposed to psychological torture for a prolonged period of time. That's a medical assessment. And we asked the four involved states to investigate this case. Unfortunately, none of the involved states have agreed to conduct an investigation, although that is their obligation under the Convention on Torture. They don't have to agree with my assessment, but they are obliged to conduct an investigation into this case, which has not been done. They have basically just rejected my assessment.
Now more than ever, government should free every person detained without sufficient legal basis, including political prisoners and others detained simply for expressing critical or dissenting views. COVID-19 poses a huge challenge to the whole society as governments take firm steps to enforce physical distancing.
I visited Julian Assange in London, in Belmarsh Prison, on the 9th of May. And then also reported back to the UK, to Sweden, the US and Ecuador, the four states that were mainly responsible for his treatment in the past 6 years. And I visited him with two medical experts. We came to the conclusion that he had been exposed to psychological torture for a prolonged period of time. That's a medical assessment. And we asked the four involved states to investigate this case. Unfortunately, none of the involved states have agreed to conduct an investigation, although that is their obligation under the Convention on Torture. They don't have to agree with my assessment, but they are obliged to conduct an investigation into this case, which has not been done. They have basically just rejected my assessment.
Now more than ever, government should free every person detained without sufficient legal basis, including political prisoners and others detained simply for expressing critical or dissenting views.
We're live.
Good afternoon and welcome to this program about the COVID-19 crisis and the prison system in this country. My name's John Rees. I'm from the Don't Extradite Assange campaign, and we've got an expert panel of guests today who are going to be discussing this all too rarely seriously examined question. I'm joined this afternoon by Richard Garside, who's the director of the Crime and Justice Centre. I'm joined also by Faith Spear, who's a criminologist and a former prison monitor, and by Steve Gillen, who's the General Secretary of the Prison Officers Association. That's the trade union that represents prison workers. So I'm going to first of all open up the discussion by asking them each a leading question into the debate. But this afternoon's about what you watching want to discuss as well. So don't forget, on Zoom, there's a Q&A function. You can go to that, click on it, write out your question, and I'll try and get as many of those questions in to our panel as we possibly can in the course of the next hour. If you're watching on Facebook, you can put a question there, and we'll try and get that through to our panelists as well. So we do face an obviously enormously serious life and death situation right across the society. But there is also equally no question that there are certain areas of our community that are enormously vulnerable. We've seen that old people in care homes have borne the brunt of this disease in a way that perhaps few other sections have. And it seems that the society doesn't always understand the duty of care that it has when it's faced with those communities. Prisoners and the people who work in prisons are another such community. Often unable to prevent the spread of disease in the way that the rest of us can, they present an enormously difficult choices, both for themselves and for those to whose business it is to look after them. So first of all, let me go to Richard Garsard. Richard, you're very welcome here. Just give me some sense of how you think the government and the prison system has been able to respond to this absolutely unique challenge. Just a second, Richard, and I'll unmute you. Okay.
Thank you very much for that introduction, John. And I think the first thing to say is, prior to the coronavirus crisis, which is certainly a crisis in prisons as well as in wider society, prisons were already in a dreadful state. The chief inspector of prisons, Peter Clark, in a recent annual report, remarked at the time, and this was prior to the coronavirus problems emerging, remarked on a deeply troubling situation in prisons. He described far too many prisons were plagued by drugs, violence, appalling living conditions, and lack of access to meaningful rehabilitative activity. He described levels of self-harm as disturbingly high, and pointed out that self-inflicted deaths had increased by nearly one-fifth on the previous year, and too many prisoners, he noted, were enduring very poor and overcrowded living conditions. So that was a situation prior to coronavirus even being identified as a threat to human health. And that's the kind of the situation that prisons were in going into this. We have currently over 80,000 people in custody, mostly men and boys. You know, my own view is that we could certainly halve the prison population without significantly reducing public safety. Indeed, it would probably enhance it, though that would obviously take many years to do, I suspect. But, you know, that's behind some of the arguments recently from a range of bodies, including the Prison Governors Association, Public Health England, and I know that the POA are also very concerned about this, but I'll leave Steve to talk about that. You know, something about reducing the numbers in custody to reduce the overcrowding, to at least give prisons a fighting chance to contain this awful virus. Now, this is important because as an epidemiologist by the name of Richard Coker pointed out a few weeks ago, prisons act as what he called epidemiological pumps. And what he meant by that is that, you know, what goes on in prison doesn't stay in prison. You know, you've got, in normal circumstances, something of the order of about 1,500 people going in and out of prison every week, as going into prison as prisoners, coming out of prison as released prisoners. You know, each one of those a potential coronavirus carrier. And although the numbers going into prison has fallen recently because the courts are largely closed, with courts starting to open again, we're likely to see a surge of people going into prison, and of course people coming out of prison, often just, you know, given a travel warrant, on the train off they go, you know, potential spreaders of the disease. Now, to date, the way that the government has approached this is by effectively introducing a version of lockdown in prisons. So prisoners kept in prisons for 23 and a half hours a day, in their cells rather, a day, let out for very short periods of time, you know, which is incredibly stressful and difficult for the prisoners and also for the staff, who are having to deal with a lot of very difficult, you know, kind of emotions and feelings about that. And it's worth bearing in mind that, you know, I mean, prisoners are being expected to live in conditions that the vast majority of us would consider to be completely unacceptable. But so are staff being expected to work in those conditions, working in conditions which are bad for their health, bad for their well-being, as well as for the health and well-being of prisoners. And it kind of, it feels to me that the current lack of action by the government on this, I mean, what they're basically doing at the moment is locking down prisons and improvising a series of additional cells in the form of refitted shipping containers. This is not a serious response to a serious public health crisis. And I think what it's kind of telling me is that, you know, we have this kind of prevailing attachment to prisons as a form of punishment, as a response to crime, which even in the face of a major crisis, which should be at least prompting a rethink, showing nothing of the sort. And Britain's far behind a number of the other European jurisdictions in its response in that regard.
Mm.
The final thing I just want to say really is just broadening this out people are in prison as a result of the rule of law. I think there's sometimes a kind of a feeling that the rule of law is being breached in terms of people being in prison, but actually the rule of law manages the process of imprisonment. It manages the process of holding people in custody, people like Julian Assange, of course. He's held there under the rule of law. And, indeed, if whether Assange is extradited or not, that will be through the process of the rule of law. So prisons perform a broader function in our society, which is rule bound. Doesn't mean they have to perform the function that they do, nor that we should have prisons at all. Actually, in my view, I'm an abolitionist. So ultimately, I'd like to see the end of all prisons, although, again, that's a long term agenda. But if we're going to get there, that will be because we change the nature of the way that society is organised so that we no longer need to rely on these very grim institutions to respond to the problems and harms that people cause.
Richard, thanks very, very much indeed. And now I want to come on to Faith Spear. Faith Spear's a criminologist. You can follow her commentary on these matters on her Twitter account and indeed on her blog as well. Faith, you're very welcome here.
Thank you.
Some of the figures that we've had, both, of course, nationally about the rate of infection, the rate of death, have been the subject of enormous debate. And it's now, I think, pretty well established that some of the government figures were considerable underestimates in the general population at large. But in prisons, there have been some reports that it may be the infection rate may be 12 times or 5 times. I've seen both figures used for the infection rate over and above the official rate. What's your feeling about that? And what's your feeling generally about how the government's handled this crisis?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Well, for me, let me just go to some information that I was sent. On the 24th of March, I was sent information issued by the Independent Monitoring Board, head of policy and communications. It read, and I quote, "Following the Prime Minister's announcement last night, independent monitoring boards should not visit the establishment they monitor for any purpose and should move fully to indirect monitoring. This includes serious incidents during which boards should arrange to be kept in contact with the command suite via telephone. We will review the position of the government's approach and the changes following the initial three-week lockdown period. But in my eyes, there's no such thing as indirect monitoring." It continued, and I quote, "It is important to maintain active contact with the establishment by phone, email, and other electronic means. As a minimum, board should ensure every member is receiving the daily briefing from the establishment and from the prison boards." This meant that IMB members had to rely on the prison staff to pass on any information, further removing any semblance of independence it ever claimed to have. But very little can be verified when you are outside a prison. Indirect monitoring is, at best, from the prison's perspective, and likely to be biased as a consequence. Then on a day later, all IMB members were sent a comprehensive letter from the IMB Secretariat under the heading "Impact on Prisoners and Detainees Reporting Mechanism." "We will be gathering board serious concerns about deteriorating conditions and treatment for prisoners detainees caused or significantly exacerbated by COVID-19, so we can bring these to ministerial senior level attention." With that said, I don't know how on earth monitors are able to collect and collate information such as this if boards can't actually go into the prison for their own safety. But then a week later, on the 30th of March, Dame Anne Owers, who is the IMB National Chair, wrote to stakeholders to update them about monitoring of prisons and immigration detention during the COVID epidemic. And I quote, given the significant health risk for prisoners, detainees and staff during the COVID-19 crisis, and following the government's advice issued this week, direct monitoring actively in prisons and immigration detention has inevitably been restricted. Boards will be able to carry on some limited on-site work where it is safe and feasible to do so. But with the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic affecting prisons, a change in direction such as this raises serious questions. How is it safer now for boards than a week ago? The Independent Monitoring Board exists to satisfy the requirements of the National Preventative Mechanism, which the UK government has signed up to as part of the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture, commonly known as OPCAT. The whole point of the UK National Preventative Mechanism is to work to prevent ill treatment in detention and implement OPCAT through independent monitoring. Although the situation is changing daily in the UK prisons, I think it's reasonable to say all scrutiny of prisons is lost for the foreseeable future, certainly for as long as the exceptional delivery model remains in place. And in practice, this means that people serving custodial sentences and on remand are kept in lockdown mode, as Richard mentioned, in cells with little or no association, no going to education or workshops, and having no visitors in prison. And one thing I said on the 5th of April is that because an exceptional delivery model has been implemented, it shows the Ministry of Justice do not want eyes and ears on them right now.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Faith. That's a fantastically interesting series of observations about the monitoring of the prisons. And I guess most people don't realise that process has been abrogated really by this crisis. Steve Gillett, let me come to you. Your members are indeed on the front line. We know that prison officers have lost their lives already in this crisis from COVID-19. So our condolences to your union and its members. You were, I believe, the POA was one of the first people to raise the question of there being an extensive release of prisoners in order to be able to deal with this. The government, first of all, said there were going to be some 4,000, I believe, was the figure given. We've ended up with some tens of prisoners actually being released. I wondered what you were thinking the state of the government's response is now.
Well, firstly, we were very interested in watching as a trade union when our sister unions in Italy, who were at the height of the pandemic out there when there was riots in prisons because things moved very quickly in Italy. So, for example, they moved from having social visits to very quickly the next day not having social visits, and it caused disruption within their prisons. And we were very conscious of that. We're also very conscious, as what Richard has just said, about the state of our prisons as well. And we've been campaigning for the last 10 years to say that our prisons are overcrowded, our prisons are violent, there's all sorts of self-harm, drugs, and everything that goes with that. And that was due to budget cuts. There's no doubt about that. The correlation between that and what was happening in our prisons was down to budget cuts from 2010. The data's there for all to see. So we were very conscious of this in February. We don't think the government acted quickly enough. I think eventually, and I know some people have been critical of the lockdown, i.e., the only things that our prisoners in our care are actually receiving at this moment in time since the 23rd of March is actually a limited form of exercise showers, medication, and mealtimes. They don't go to classes, they don't go to workshops. There are some prisoners that we call key workers, i.e. those in the kitchens and things like that, that are allowed to go to work, but under strict supervision and social distancing. I've got to say, I've got to commend some of the majority of prisoners actually in our care, from the youth justice system right up to the adult estate, because assaults, violence, you could say the reason violence has dropped is because they're not getting out of the cells. But the reality is, prisoner on prisoner, even when they're out on the exercise yard, has dropped massively. Assaults against my members have also dropped massively as well. And prisoners are actually telling prison staff that they feel safe and they understand why certain things have had to be taken place, because it was about saving lives. And I think you mentioned that at the very beginning, John, about this pandemic being extremely serious of an issue of life and death in all areas of our community. And prisoners are actually no different. There will be discussions moving on with regards to a medium-term recovery plan. But that recovery plan won't see us going back to what the status quo of before the 23rd of March. This pandemic is going to be with us probably for some time, and I think the planning will be for between the next 12 and 18 months. And I wouldn't expect to see any major changes in the coming weeks or indeed in the short term. The POA were indeed very vocal and supportive of the Secretary of State, Robert Buckland, on an executive release. I just wish they'd gone further, and I've told him that. I wanted them to go further, because it's not lost on me. This is the 30th anniversary of Strangeways. And the prison population then, when Lord Wolfe done his inquiry into it, said was a major factor in what happened at Strangeways and then copycats around the country. And we were talking then about 43,000 prisoners. Now we've got an excess of 80,000 prisoners. And there's no doubt in my mind, and the union's mind, that there's far too many prisoners, and some should have been released far quicker to free up spaces in our prisons for the health and safety of those in our care, and indeed those prison staff that work in our overcrowded prisons. Now, you're right to point out that the population has since dropped by about 3,000. There's temporary accommodation coming on stream. But of course, the courts are starting up again, and that could add pressure. I don't believe for one minute that we're out the woods in this at all, in the prison setting. And some people have mentioned, quite rightly as well, the lack of preparation in care homes and so forth. There has been preparation in prisons. I think we struggled with PPE initially. We're starting to get it sorted out. There's still a lot of confusion about when PPE should be used and can be used, and the differences between the different types of PPE, i.e. clinical masks and then ordinary masks for prison staff. So I do worry that if there's a massive clamour to go back to the normality of pre-23rd of March, it could take off. This pandemic could take off in our prisons and make things much worse. So I think, and I look forward to the rest of the debate, but I think our collaborative approach as a trade union with the government and with respective employers is paying dividend. But I will finish on this bit. I clearly said many weeks ago that my trade union would not politicise the issue. We will not have worker against worker either. But it's very sad to see already some of the media turning on the education unions, because they're insisting on safety first before schools are open. And the language that's been used against some of those education trade unions in the media today and yesterday is absolutely deplorable. The reality is, I know some of these people, I work with them at the general council level, and I don't recognise the language that's been used in the media. Trade unions are part of the solution, not the problem. And the reality is, unions should be listened to. Employers have a legal responsibility for making the workplace as safe as possible. And that isn't just in a prison context for workers. It's also in the context of the prisoners in our care as well.
Thank Steve, you, thanks very, very much. Thanks very, very much for that. And let me just sort of take up some of the points that you made there with Richard and Faith, because the whole question of an extensive release of prisoners was obviously in the government's mind. They spoke in terms of, as I've said, relatively large numbers of people being released. And then I think there was a moment where they accidentally released six prisoners that weren't meant to be released. And there was a kind of reaction, and I imagine there was a fairly strong reaction inside the Tory party as well. And from that moment on, it all ground to a halt. So the question I'd really like to put, first of all, to you, Richard, is in this kind of release, who is it that gets out? Because obviously, you know, there's a version of this which is that the public will be terrorized by dangerous people being released from prison. But certainly, we know in the case of Julian Assange that he's a remand prisoner. He hasn't actually committed a crime for which he's being held in jail, and he's not the only one, and there will be other similar categories. So perhaps, Richard, you could give us some idea of what a more extensive release program like that might entail.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I'll be brief because I know there's lots to discuss here. So, I mean, the government announced back in early April a plan to release up to 4,000 prisoners. At the time, they were being told they needed to be aimed for release about 10 or 15,000, so far below what they should have been aiming for. But, you know, it was a start. And by about earlier this week, they'd, I think, managed to release 81 out of a target 4,000. So a kind of a pathetic process, really. And we're now in a kind of a ridiculous situation where they've bought 2,000 tags. Electronic monitoring tag, supposedly to be used for monitoring all these people they're releasing, which they don't have anything to do with them. So they're now casting around for something to do with all these tags they've bought. And, you know, there's probably lots of reasons, you know, why the process has ground to a halt. And the reasons that you outlined, John, I'm sure are part of it. In terms of who should be released, well, you know, I mean, we've got about just under 2,000 prisoners who the Secretary of State himself would said that were they living in the community, they would be subject to some form of shielding because of their vulnerability. And that's largely in relation to age. There's about almost 2,000 prisoners who are 70 or over. And indeed, it was very tragic. The first prisoner who died in England and Wales was an 84-year-old in prison. So, you know, if they were going to be serious about it, they would start, I would argue, with those who are most at risk of, if they contract coronavirus, of dying from it. Because prisons are no places for somebody who's very ill. And that's probably, you know, 4,000 to 5,000 people. If you kind of went for everybody who's basically 60 years old and plus, that would be one way. Pregnant women, another category. And they have actually started to release pregnant women, though, again, most pregnant women in custody are still in custody. They haven't been released yet. There are then going to be some other considerations. So you shouldn't be obviously releasing people to homelessness. So that's one of the categories. You might want to think in terms of, does this person have a home to go to? And indeed, if they do have a home to go to, then they can come and join the rest of us on house arrest. You know, it's not the risk they might pose to other people in that sense, relatively small, except, and it's a very, very important qualification, if the reason why they're in custody is because stuff they've done at home, you know, so child sexual abuse, domestic violence and those kinds of issues. Clearly, what we don't want to do is be releasing someone out of prisons to go back to the scene of their crimes, in a sense. So there are definitely some complexities here. But I do think that, you know, had the government, you know, been kind of on this from the beginning, they could have done a lot better. I mean, you know, France, just across the channel for us, by the end of last month, they'd released at least 10,000, or rather 10,000 fewer people were in prison at a time when we had about 2,500 fewer. And given the proportionate differences in the prison population, had we achieved that kind of level, we would have about 12,000 to 15,000 fewer people in prison. France managed it in a month. I don't really see why we couldn't have done the same.
Faith, your views on this aspect of it. Go ahead.
Well, the thing for me is that Public Health England recommended 15,000 prisoners be released. The government then decided on 4,000, and that, you know, that might seem, well, that's quite a significant amount of people. But then when the clarity came in, they were saying 4,000 will be eligible. One didn't say that we were going to release 4,000, it's just that 4,000 will be eligible. So it's this misleading information that we often get. But for me, I believe that the government does not have real intention on releasing prisoners to reduce the prison population. Because if it did, it would have done something about it already. It wouldn't have waited for a crisis such as COVID-19 to come in. Because they've got these building programs already on the go to build additional places. The first lot was included Wellingborough and Glenparver prisons, but now they're talking about an additional 10,000 places. So the population, they're not really looking at reducing it. And so all this information, you know, make it sound, you know, look what we're doing. I think it's very misleading, very misleading. So it's hard for me to actually believe what they say. Because it changes all the time, doesn't it? As we've seen this week.
Yeah, Steve, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Because they seem to have gone from talk of reducing the prison population to much more emphasis on expanding capacity. But is what they're doing expanding capacity on the cheap, with inadequate facilities? Because you read some of the stuff about the new places that they're creating, and that certainly has to be a question in your mind. What's your view?
Well, we have already been on record as saying that those additional spaces, the public sector will not be able to bid for. They're just going to be given to the private sector. And we think that is totally flawed. We think the whole private sector argument is flawed anyway. But successive governments, whether it was Tory or Labour, they've increased the privatisation agenda throughout the United Kingdom. I do worry that not enough was done. I think Public Health England, when they mentioned the 15,000, that was in relation to freeing up spaces so that prisoners could have single cell accommodation. I'm not sure that Public Health England were actually saying 15,000 prisoners should be released. And I think governments, no matter who the government is, I'll try and make it non-political, they worry about the public reaction and the reaction from the media about releasing prisoners back into the community. There seems to be, in this country, an overwhelming appetite to lock people up and throw away the key. But the reality is, and the British public need to understand this, 98% of prisoners will someday be released back into the community. That's the reality. And what we're saying is more should be done to divert people away from prison, such as the mentally ill and people. I mean, my union hasn't got a position on individuals about who should be locked up and who shouldn't be locked up. That's not for our union to determine or to comment on. But I think we're compassionate enough to know that we've all come across people that shouldn't be in prison. It costs more to keep them in prison, actually, than it does to keep them out of prison. And I've got to say, we've all come across those poor individuals that we think, good God almighty. I mean, I've been in the, you know, around the criminal justice system now for 30 years. And I've seen some very sad cases that shouldn't be, have been anywhere near a prison in the first place. And I think that's a bit of a sad indictment on our society, actually. And I think we need to get to grips with that, because not every prisoner is a danger to society. Lots of those prisoners that were talked about for the early release and executive release, in actual fact, were coming to the end of the sentence anyway. So they shouldn't have needed a home detention tag and so forth. They should have just been released, and it should have been quickened up. And Richard was right to highlight France, as other countries such as Spain, Italy, Iran, around the world, even in America, where they've been releasing prisoners very, very quickly. And that's to safeguard not just prisoners in our care that are doubled up into cells. It's to safeguard my members who work really professionally on behalf of society and don't get the recognition that they actually deserve, quite frankly.
Okay, let me just move on there. One of the things that's being asked in the questions is about the quality of justice that's being delivered in this period. Faith's already talked about the removal of monitoring from the prison system, which has to be of a very high order of concern for anybody who wants the system to be administered fairly, who wants it to be able to do what it's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But certainly one of the things that we've observed in the course of the procedural hearings for Julian is that he can't even safely go to the video room to participate in the proceedings from Belmarsh prison. So he's been advised on medical grounds not to go into that room on two occasions. So he isn't present at his own procedural hearings. The lawyers aren't present in court. The press access to the court is severely restricted. So perhaps this is just something that's affecting the Assange trial, but that's hard to imagine. There must be a deterioration of the ability of lawyers to see their clients, of them to properly represent them in court, from the clients to be present. Faith, do you think this is a general problem, that we are going to see a deterioration of the quality of justice because of the crisis?
Well, I don't think this is going to end anytime soon. If you can't have access to the people that you need, or if you can't have, well, if everything is dependent on a prisoner being moved in order to be able to go into a room and there's a monitor there, it can do the video calls or whatever. If you haven't got the staff that's going to get you there, or it's not seen as a priority, there's going to be a lot of problems that way. You're not going to have the correct communication between each person. And the court system, although the courts are supposed to be opening more in the next couple of weeks, if for people's safety, they cannot actually meet together. When you see the state of the courts, they haven't got the equipment really to deal with everything this way. The technology is not there, because the actual infrastructure isn't there. We haven't had the money going into the court system, into the prison system, like has been needed. It's all behind. So we can't suddenly develop the technology for everything to go smoothly as if you're face to face. It's not there. The money's not there. The unwillingness to invest is not there. And with the cuts, with the austerity cuts, the department has, I think it's 40% cuts. If you can't sustain anything on that. So to go forward, if you haven't got the infrastructure in place already, it's not going to be there. They're not going to just suddenly invest And it's very difficult to replace face-to-face, having those meetings that you desperately need, having the contact that you desperately need. It's not the same if you haven't got the equipment, if you haven't got actually got the people there face-to-face. You can't do it. You can't. So, I mean, it's difficult to know how they're going to progress cases. And the same with Julian Assange case. You know, if he's not able to go and communicate in the way that he needs to, we don't know what's going to happen, do we? We can't actually write the script because we do not know what it's going to be like.
Mm. Richard, what's your view? Do you think this is corroding the kind of quality of justice that's deliverable by the system?
Well, I mean, let's not get misty-eyed about British justice. I mean, you know, on the one hand, for sure, you know, compared with many jurisdictions, we have a, you know, very proud tradition of being a law-bound society and being a society which respects the rule of law, and there's nothing wrong with that per se. But, you know, you only have to think about various miscarriages of justice in the past and in the present to realise that British justice is not always particularly just. I mean, the thing about the court system, again, rather like the prison system, the court system entered this crisis already in a crisis. There was a legal aid crisis, for example, where, you know, successive governments have been trying to pare back the amount of legal aid available, both in terms of whether you can get legal aid, but also, you know, the amount of representation you can get, and, you know, lawyers having to work ridiculous hours for very little. I mean, you know, the kind of cliche that actually, if you're a legal aid lawyer these days, you can probably earn more stacking shelves in Tesco's than you can actually working as a legal aid lawyer. And that's no disrespect to people who stack shelves in Tesco's. You know, it's a very important job. But, you know, at the end of the day, barristers have trained many, many years to get to the point of being able to represent clients, and the pay is absolutely atrocious. And of course, that has an impact on the quality of the representation. And then, as Spade said, the issue then about digital justice, which has been a big thing for governments, you know, for at least the last 10 years, but very kind of problematic in many ways, difficulty accessing information in case files, questions of whether the lawyers have the correct information, and indeed the defendants do. And that, again, is before the current crisis. So the idea that, you know, more or less overnight, you know, the judicial proceedings can all kind of effectively, you can flick a switch and everyone can kind of do representation from their back room or their bedroom via Skype or Zoom is a kind of a ridiculous proposition. This, of course, is one of the other reasons why courts were effectively kind of closed down for a period of time. There haven't been any jury trials for a while, for example, and that was partly about social distancing issues, but it was also just recognising that when you have these very complex cases, it's difficult to not, if you're not doing those in person. Where we end up, on the basis that this is going to be several months at least before anything approaching normality can return, a really good question. And it certainly concerns me that if you have individuals, you know, you mentioned Julian Assange earlier, you know, who effectively can't attend their own hearings because they're being advised it's not safe to do so. I mean, that's, you know, a very problematic situation, to put it mildly. Mm.
Steve, if this is a reasonably widespread thing, and I guess it must be, the court system backing up, if nothing else, does that contribute to the tension inside the prisons? If prisoners feel they aren't getting the access to the lawyers, if they're not being processed through the court system with the speed that they expected, do your members find that they're dealing with a kind of even more tense situation than perhaps they would do normally?
Well, it really is an interesting question, because I get the feeling at this moment in time from the feedback that we're getting is that relationships between prisoners and staff have actually improved since the 23rd of March. Whether it's because of prisoners feeling very vulnerable as well, because of the situation with regards to this pandemic, that might have applied the minds to that. I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, there will be a backlog of cases in the courts, and that is a concern, and it is a massive concern that the rule of law has to be applied and so forth, and I'm equally concerned about that, because as people well know, my own trade union were held in contempt of court for allegedly breaching a permanent injunction. We say that was protecting the health and safety of our members and indeed those in our care. The courts took a different view and found us guilty of contempt of court and fined the union £200,000 and two separate cases. We are appealing that decision at the moment. We haven't had the leave to appeal as yet to the Supreme Court because of the COVID-19 and the delays to the judicial system. But I'm hoping that we do get the leave to appeal because we feel very strongly about that situation. So I would imagine...
Not everybody will be familiar with that. So just what was the substance of those complaints?
Well, I think you will know that, and you're right, some members of the public don't understand that prison officers do not have the right to strike, and that was taken away in 1994, and it's been there ever since. We say that we still come under the health and safety legislation of serious and imminent danger, section 44, that gives any individual the right to leave the workplace if they're in serious and imminent danger. And on occasions, the PRA have, so one of the cases was at Liverpool, where they didn't feel safe in respect of mixed messages coming in relation to what use of force could be used. One of our members was sacked, since reinstated, by the way, but that led to friction at Liverpool jail, and Liverpool prison officers refused to work on that day. We managed to get it resolved with the clarity that we needed. Prior to that, there was a national walkout under health and safety because of all the issues that Richard talked about earlier, the violence against my members, the violence in our jails, the conditions in our jails. And I've got to say, if it was any other workforce, they would have legitimately balloted for strike action, but we're not allowed to, and that's the issue. So we had a permanent injunction against us. Now, it may be that some people believe that prison officers shouldn't have the right to strike. And we say, if we haven't got the right to strike, then give us adequate compensatory mechanisms for resolving ongoing disputes and pay and other terms and conditions, because we haven't got that. So we've had to do something in relation to that to bring it to the public's attention about the conditions in our prisons, not just for staff, but for prisoners as well. And the full weight of the court and the law came down against us because we were judged to have been in contempt of court. I find that sad because other countries, prison officers do have the right to strike. In some respects, we have operational support grades that are allowed actually to take industrial action up to including strike action. And you know what? We very rarely use it. And it's the same in the special hospitals, the secure hospitals, where I could count on one hand where they are allowed to take strike action, where I've actually sanctioned that strike action. So that's it in a nutshell. But in the wider context of things, this pandemic will slow things down, unfortunately. There will be a backlog of legal cases that will affect lots and lots of people in our communities, and indeed those that are on remand and prisons and so forth. And it could add to tensions, but I'm pleased to say at this moment in time it hasn't, because prison officers, because of the professional manner in which they're doing stuff with prisoners, it's actually the communication, because we've actually got an overtime system where at this moment in time, there is an excess of staff working in the majority of our jails. It's almost like gone back pre-2010, where prison officers actually have the time to sit and talk to prisoners and talk about the issues that are top of their agenda, if you like, and understand. Whereas before, because there wasn't enough staff, and prisoners were just milling about doing nothing on association, prisoners didn't feel safe themselves because they were being bullied by the hierarchical structure. in our jails, the debts, fallen into drug habits and so forth. So at this moment in time, I think the relationship between prisoners and staff is good, because both recognise that this pandemic doesn't matter whether you're a prisoner or a member of staff. If you're going to get it, you're going to get it.
Okay, let me just talk about a little bit, actually, because Steve's brought us back there to the kind of core issues surrounding surrounding health. And one of the things that we know about COVID-19 is that it affects people who have underlying health conditions more readily than others. So one of the reasons why Julian Assange's bail was requested was that he had an underlying lung condition. But Richard, how big a section of the prison population is it that would be vulnerable because of underlying health conditions? Is that, as I imagine it probably is, a higher proportion than in the population at large?
Well, yes. I mean, and I'm sure Steve will have some thoughts on this as well. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's partly the question of older prisoners, which, as I said, there's around 5,000 to 6,000 over the age of 60. And one of the things that imprisonment does, particularly if you're imprisoned for a relatively lengthy sentence, is it ages you. You know, so there have been studies performed on this, which found that, you know, basically prisoners, if you're in prison, it can put up to 10 years on you, just in terms of your kind of, you know, where you, you know, biological age and kind of, in a sense, you know, your immune system and all your other kind of health issues. Then, of course, there's the lack of exercise. There's a lack of sunlight, something as mundane but important as vitamin D, and other kind of vitamin deficiencies. There's actually sometimes compromised immune systems, because precisely because you're not in the general population, you're not necessarily exposed to the full panoply of all the kinds of, you know, bugs and all the rest that, you know, we all face when we travel on a bus or on the train or just walk around. So those are all of those things. Then, of course, in addition, you've just got all the other issues, and notably, of course, lots of people in prison with underlying drug problems, alcohol problems, and other kind of health conditions, which, you know, can significantly affect their underlying, you know, their immune systems, their underlying health. So it's a big issue. I mean, my own view is we should certainly start by really thinking about those older populations, and then particular groups. And so pregnant women are an obvious case in point. Prisoners with families, particularly younger children, and indeed, of course, young prisoners, you know, held away. I mean, you know, from their parents. I mean, how terrifying is it going to be if you're a 15-year-old in custody at a time like this? How stressful and distressing for your parents and those who care and love you. So I think there's a number of things that we could do. And in a sense, my own view is that we should be pursuing the same approach as we're pursuing for the population at large. So we're shielding the elderly, we're shielding those with underlying health conditions. We're ensuring that those who potentially could have a very adverse reaction to coronavirus, were they to catch it, have certain forms of kind of support and guidance. The same should be true of those in prison.
Faith. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you're on.
Well, prisons aren't noted as healthy environments anyway, are they? Standards of healthcare, although we're led to believe that in normal circumstances you should have the equivalent that you would have in the community, but as we often see, that is a postcode lottery anyway. So when you've got something as serious as COVID-19 coming into the restricted environment such as a prison, it's, and because I'm not aware of anything quite as dangerous as this in the prisons before, there isn't anything that you can go to. Oh, well, let's just get down that that study. Oh yes, when we went through this before, we did this. It's all new. It's all new. We don't actually know how many people it will affect. We do get statistics to tell us how many it has affected so far, but we don't really know what is going to happen in the future. Thursday, the 14th of May, the stats that we had was that 405 prisoners had tested positive across 74 prisons, and 528 prison staff had tested across 71 prisons. So we can see that it is really getting through the prison estate quite rapidly when we think that it's only really a couple of months. We don't know what the next couple of months will hold, because we don't know how it will affect. There is no vaccination, so it's like we can't suddenly put a stop to it. We don't know who is actually a carrier, and because there is a change of staff, they're then with their families during the evening, they come back into work. We don't know how it's transmitted or who is transmitting it. We don't know. It's very difficult to plan ahead when we don't really understand what is happening. And I'm sure that the staff are doing the best that they can. It's their safety that's important as well as the prisoners. So we can't ignore that. The only people that I suppose we can see that are safe in this is the fact that the families aren't able to come in. So we haven't got that transmission through the families at the moment. But it's very difficult to think what is going to happen in the future, because we do not know. So, as I said before, it's difficult. We don't want to write the script. We don't want to offer, positives when we don't actually know. So I think we have to be really careful, what kind of information we put out.
Steve, with this question of underlying health conditions for prisoners, when your members are dealing with this, do they feel that the kind of facilities, the medical care facilities in the prisons, are adequate? I mean, the rest of us get ill, we go to the doctor, go to the hospital. There's nowhere to go in prison. You can only go to the medical facilities in the prison. And do you have a concern that the medical facilities in prisons aren't really up to dealing with something like this, or not?
I think prisons are very complex, and I think Richard got it spot on when he said about the sort of vulnerabilities and the illnesses that some prisoners have, whether it's through alcoholism, drugs, whether it's because they're elderly, underlying medical conditions and so forth. But it is very complex. And the majority of prisoners actually that fall ill in prisons will end up going out to an outside hospital for medical treatment rather than being treated internally, because we haven't got the facilities of 24-hour cover. In many of our prisons now, it's just a thing of the past. When I joined many years ago, then I would have suggested the healthcare provisions were slightly better than they probably are now because of the budget cuts that we've actually seen. There is no magic wand to this, and I think Faith got it right. There's no manual that you can go to and say, well, look at page 46 in this to see where we go next. It was bad enough dealing with other communicable diseases in prisons, such as TB and things like that, and even things like lice and so forth. But the reality is, this is something totally different. Mm-hmm. This is a pandemic that even the scientists can't agree all the time on where we go next with it. So I think people are going to have to be patient. We will continue as a trade union to work in a collaborative approach with the government, with the variety of employers that we see, whether it's in the private sector, public sector, or home office and immigration. But by working in a collaborative approach, that shouldn't be seen as a sign of weakness, because where issues aren't correct, the POA have a history of raising them, and raising them in a very strong but evidence-based way, and we hope it doesn't fall on deaf ears, because the lives of prisoners in our care, whether it's a young boy or whether it's a female prisoner or whether it's in the adult estate or immigration services, is most prison officers, the majority of prison officers, take great care in and pride in the job that they do. And we don't want to see prisoners die. We don't want to see members of staff die. We want to get this right and keep the lid on it. But I fear we've got a long way to go. And that test will come in the coming months, weeks and months. And I just hope that people don't try and rush going forward by trying to do too much too quickly. There are different models now coming out. You know, some prisons have actually started social visits by video link. Mm-hmm. And it's been really well received by those in our care, you know, been able to speak to the families, you know, by video, something that we probably take for granted. The reality is it's that human touch again, and we should never underestimate that, because if we do, then we've got all sorts of problems within our prisons. And I think we've got to recognise that prisoners are people too. Mm-hmm. We have to forget that in the British justice system, then we've lost that forever. And we need to get that message across to the British public, because I see so much on social media where it's very poisonous towards individuals, that because they've committed a crime, that we should just lock the door, forget about them, and perhaps execute them, God knows what. That can't be the way forward in Great Britain as a country. I think we've got to be measured about how we treat people in prison, how we treat people in our care homes, and in society. And at the moment, I'm not sure we've totally got it right. I think there's far too many people in prison.
Let me just stay with you a minute on precisely that issue, because there's a question come up from Susan Mayer, who's written in saying, how do prison officers talk to prisoners? I think that's in response to you saying about the conversations that were taking place when prisoners are locked up in their cells for 23 hours a day. I mean, obviously, the lockdown is pretty literal in prison. So what's your response to that question?
Sorry, I missed the question. How do they speak to
prisoners? How do prison officers talk to prisoners when the prisoners are locked up for 23 hours a day? So I guess it's about how much contact there is there how much contact is possible.
You will get the sort of situation where they've been doing education behind closed doors and things like that as well. And prison officers do let them out to use the telephone in a controlled manner. So that they're socially distancing, to shower every day, so that they're doing that. So there will be that interaction with staff, and staff are actually going around doing some elements of key work, speaking to prisoners, understanding the problems, their concerns, and so forth. And, you know, since the 23rd of March, I'm pleased to say that actually self-harm has dropped. And I think it's because when I joined the prison service 30 years ago, I knew the groups of prisoners on my landing. I had time to know that if a certain individual wasn't coming out of the cell, what was wrong with them. But because now our prisons are so overcrowded, the modern day prison officer just doesn't have that time to speak and build up a relationship with the prisoners on their landing and wing. And I think at the moment, that situation, from what I've been told, not just by staff, but by prisoners' families who have emailed in saying that the POA actually has been the voice for prisoners as well in some of the interviews that we've done on TV, because we don't forget about the prisoners in our care. We want to make sure that they're okay. And the last thing, as I've said before, we want is prisoners falling ill and dying because of this pandemic. We don't want to see that happening, because I think it's all too easy when you turn on the news and we see 33,000 people have died from coronavirus. They become a statistic. And behind those statistics is a human life that's been lost. And there's people in real pain around this country and other countries that have lost their loved ones. And I don't want to see that happen in a prison setting. And at the moment, the modelling hasn't come to fruition on what they thought that pandemic would occur and the death rate in our prisons. And long may that continue.
Okay. We're coming up on the hour now, so I'm just going to give Richard Garside and Faith a chance to just sum up, but it's going to have to be brief. So just let me put it to you in this way. If there were one thing that you could make the government do in the prison system at the moment to improve the circumstances in which we're dealing with COVID-19, what would it be? Richard Garside.
Well, I mean, very simply, start releasing people on a rather more aggressive and enthusiastic basis. You know, let's use France as the kind of the target, you know, see if we can kind of beat them in that sense. I think we just need to get people out of custody. And we need to make sure as much as possible we're not sending people into custody unnecessarily.
Okay. And Faith, I can put it to you as one of the people on the Q&A have put it. It's a question from Joe Prisonstorm. He said, do today's speakers believe any material change will be realised in the way prisons are designed, built, maintained, operated and funded so that lessons are learned from the COVID crisis?
I'd have to say no. When you think of the last prison that was built, Berwyn, it was built with 70% double cells, 30% single cells, even though it was recommended that there's more single cells for prisoners. I've had a look around that new prison. I've seen the kind of, although everything was nice and new and bright and shiny, it's not good to be building more prisons like that. I don't think lessons are ever learnt. We've got two more prisons that are in the process of being built, and if we're basing it on what we've got, we're looking at the wrong way. We've got to look forward. If we are going to build prisons, and I don't believe that we should be, my personal opinion, we should not be doing that, but we can't look at what we've done before. We have to look for something new, innovative, and certainly not Titan prisons.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave it there because all three of you have really said there has to be a different way forward. And I definitely think that, having followed closely the recent sort of prison experience and the court experience of the Assange case, I couldn't agree more with that. Just let me say to viewers, thanks very much for looking in. If you want to know more about what Richard Garside's been talking about, then he's the director of the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies, and you can see their work on their website. You can follow Faith Spear on her Twitter account and see the link to her blog there. And of course, Steve Gillen is the General Secretary of the Prison Officers Association, and their Twitter feed and website is there for you to follow their work as well. My thanks to them all for joining us. My name is John Rees. I'm from the Defend the Don't Extradite Assange campaign. You can follow the case of Julian Assange, who is probably the most famous prisoner in the country. He's certainly been cited as one of the reasons why the prison system in this country isn't working properly, his treatment in the courts and in the prison system. You can follow that case and all that it involves for freedom of the press by looking at the Don't Extradite Assange website, Facebook page, Twitter feed, and the YouTube channel, where this programme, along with others, will be available for you to share and bring to attention of your friends and workmates. But for now, thanks for watching. Thanks to my guests. Take care.
Now okay, more than ever, government should free every person detained without sufficient legal basis, including political prisoners and others detained simply for expressing critical or dissenting views. Yes. COVID-19 poses a huge challenge to the whole society as governments take firm steps to enforce this.